Chapter 70. They began arriving in the thousands the first day, in the tens of thousands the next. From all over northern Mexico, people inspired by the impassioned ravings of Topiltzin traveled by car, overloaded bus and truck, or walked to the dusty town of Miguel Alemán across the river from Roma. The asphalt roads from Monterrey, Tampico, and Mexico City were glutted with a continuous stream of vehicles. President De Lorenzo tried to stop the human avalanche rolling toward the border. He called out the Mexican armed forces to block the roads. The military might as well have tried to stop a raging flood. Outside of Guadalupe, a squad of soldiers about to be swept away by a crush of bodies fired into the crowd, killing 54, most of them women and children. De Lorenzo had unwittingly played into Topiltzin's hands. It was exactly the reaction Robert Capister had hoped for. Riots broke out in Mexico City, and De Lorenzo realized he had to back off or face mushrooming unrest and the lighted match of a possible revolution. He sent a message to the White House with his sincere regrets for failing to stem the tide, and then he called off the soldiers, many of whom deserted and joined the crusade. Unrestrained, the throng swarmed toward the Rio Grande. The Capister family's hired professional planners and Robert's Topiltzin followers raised a 5-square-kilometer tent city and set up kitchens and organized food lines. Sanitation facilities were trucked in and assembled. Nothing was overlooked. Many of the poor who flooded the area had never lived nor eaten so well. Only the clouds of dust and exhaust smoke from diesel engines swirled beyond human control. Hand-painted banners appeared along the Mexican bank of the river proclaiming, "The U.S. stole our land. We want our ancestors' land returned. The antiquities belong to Mexico." They chanted the slogans in English, Spanish, and Nahuatl. Topiltzin walked among the masses, agitating them into a frenzy rarely seen outside Iran. Television news teams had a field day taping the colorful demonstration. Cameras, their cables meandering to 24 mobile field units, stood tripod to tripod on top of Roma's bluff, lenses panning the opposite shore. Unwary correspondents who wandered through the crowds did not know that the peasant families they interviewed had been carefully planted and rehearsed. In most cases, the simple, impoverished-looking people were trained actors who spoke fluent English, but answered questions in a stumbling, broken accent. Their tearful appeals to live permanently in California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas drew a wave of sob-sister support across the nation when the segments ran on the evening news and the morning talk shows. The only ones who stood grim and unimpressed were the dedicated men of the U.S. Border Patrol. Until now, the threat of a massive incursion had only been a nightmare. Now they were about to witness the realization of their worst fears. Border patrolmen rarely had call to draw their firearms. They treated illegal immigrants humanely and with respect before shipping them back home. They took a dim view of the army troops covering the U.S. side of the river like nests of camouflaged ants. They saw only disaster and slaughter in a long line of automatic weapons and the 20 tanks whose deadly guns were trained on Mexico. The soldiers were young and efficient as fighting units, but they were trained for combat with an enemy who fought back. They were uneasy about facing a wave of unarmed civilians. The commanding officer, Brigadier General Curtis Chandler, had barricaded the bridge with tanks and armored cars, but Topiltzin had planned for that contingency. The riverbank was packed with every kind of small boat, wooden raft, and truck inner tube gleaned within 200 miles. Footbridges made of rope were stretched out and knotted to be carried across by the first wave and positioned. General Chandler's intelligence officer estimated an initial rush of 20,000 before the flotilla returned, loaded, and ferried the next wave. He couldn't begin to guess the number of swimmers. One of his female agents had penetrated the dining trailer used by Topiltzin aides and reported the storm would be launched in the late evening after the Aztec Messiah had whipped his devotees into near frenzy. But she couldn't learn which evening. Chandler had served 3 tours in Vietnam. He knew firsthand what it was like to kill fanatical young women and boys who struck without warning out of the jungle. He gave orders to fire over the heads of the mob as they began their move across the water. If the warning barrage did not stop them, Chandler was a soldier who performed his duty without question. If ordered, he would use the forces under his command to repel the peaceful invasion, regardless of the cost in blood. Pitt stood on the second-story sun deck of Sam Trinity's store and peered through a telescope used by the Texan to gaze at the stars. The sun had dropped over the western range of hills, and daylight was fading. But the staged spectacle on the other side of the Rio Grande was about to begin. Batteries of multicolored floodlights burst out, some sweeping patterns in the sky, while others beamed on a tall tower that had been erected in the center of the town. He focused on and magnified a tiny figure wearing a white ankle-length robe and colorful headdress, who stood on a narrow platform atop the tower. Pitt judged from the upraised and brisk movement of the arms that the center of attraction was engaged in a fervent speech. "I wonder who the character is in the jazzy costume stirring up the natives." Sandecker sat with Lily, examining the underground profile recordings from the survey. He looked up at Pitt's question. "Probably that phony Topiltzen," he grunted. "He can sway a crowd with the best of the evangelists."
"Any sign they'll attempt the crossing tonight?" asked Lily.
Pitt leaned back from the telescope and shook his head. "They're hard at work on their fleet, but I doubt if it will come for another 48 hours. Topiltzen won't launch his big push until he's certain he commands the lead news story of the day."
"Topiltzen is an alias," Sandecker informed him. "His real name is Robert Capister."
"He's got himself a thriving racket."
Sandecker held up one thumb and forefinger an inch apart. "Capister is that far away from taking over Mexico. If that convention on the other side of the river is any indication, he's after the entire American Southwest, too."
Lily stood up and stretched.
"This sitting around is driving me crazy. We do all the work and the Army engineers get all the glory. Preventing us from watching over the excavation and keeping us off Sam's property, I think it's rude of them."
Pitt and Sandecker both smiled at Lily's feminine choice of words.
"I could put it a little stronger than rude," said the Admiral.
Lily chewed nervously on the tip of a pen.
"Why no word from the Senator? We should have heard something by now."
"I can't say," replied Sandecker.
"All he told me after I explained Dirk's setup was that he'd somehow work a deal."
"Wish we knew how it was going," Lily murmured.
Trinity appeared on the stairs below, wearing an apron.
"Anybody care for a bowl of my famous Trinity chili?"
Lily gave him an uneasy look.
"How hot is it?"
"Little lady, I can make it as mild on your stomach as a marshmallow or as fiery as battery acid, any way you like it."
"I'll go with the marshmallow," Lily decided without hesitation.
Before Pitt and Sandecker could put in their order, Trinity turned and stared through the dusk at a stream of headlights approaching up the road.
"Must be another Army convoy," he announced. "Been no cars or trucks come this way since that general closed off the roads and rerouted all the traffic to the north."
Soon they counted 5 trucks led by a Hummer, the vehicle that replaced the durable Jeep. The truck bringing up the rear pulled a trailer with a canvas-covered piece of equipment. The convoy did not turn off the road toward the engineers' encampment on Gongora Hill or continue into Roma as expected. The trucks followed the Hummer into the driveway of Sam's Roman Circus and stopped between the gas pumps and the store. The passengers climbed from the Hummer and looked around. Pitt immediately recognized 3 familiar faces. 2 of the men were in uniform, while the 3rd wore a sweater and denims. Pitt climbed carefully over the railing and lowered himself until he was only a few feet off the ground. Then he let go and landed directly in front of them, uttering a low groan at the sudden pain from his wounded leg. They were as startled by his sudden appearance as he was by theirs.
"Where'd you drop from?" asked Al Giordino with a broad smile.
He looked pale under the floodlights and his arm was in a sling, but he looked testy as ever.
"I was about to ask you the same thing."
Colonel Hollis stepped forward.
"I didn't think we'd meet up again so quickly."
"Nor I," added Major Dillinger.
Pitt felt a vast wave of relief rush over him as he grasped their outstretched hands.
"To say I'm glad to see you has to be the year's understatement.
How is it you're here?"
"Your father used his powers of persuasion on the Joint Chiefs of Staff," explained Hollis. "I'd hardly finished my report on the Lady Flamborough mission when orders came down to assemble the teams and rush here by vehicle transportation using backcountry roads. All very hush and classified.
I was told the field commander would not be apprised of our mission until I reported to him.
General Chandler, said Pitt.
Yes, Steel Trap Chandler. I served under him in NATO 8 years ago. Still thinks armor alone can win wars. So he's got the dirty job of playing Horatio defending the bridge.
What are your orders? Asked Pitt.
To assist you and Dr. Sharp on whatever project you've got going. Admiral Sandecker is to act as a direct line to the Senator and the Pentagon. That's about all I know.
No mention of the White House?
None that's down on paper.
He turned as Lily and the Admiral, who had taken the long way down the inside stairs, rushed out the front door. As Lily embraced Giordino and Dillinger introduced himself to Sandecker, Hollis pulled Pitt aside.
What the devil is going on around here? He muttered. A circus?
Pitt grinned.
You don't know how close you are.
Where do my special forces fit in?
When the free-for-all starts, said Pitt, turning deadly serious, your job is to blow the store.